Test, test, test. Okay. Do you get everything?
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
Okay, me too. Okay, good morning. So I guess I know which keyword I shouldn't put in a talk next time. Linux and Windows are probably a killer for the audience. So the work I'm going to present is about a port of Daminet and IPFW from FreeBSD to different platforms, specifically Linux, Windows, and we also have a userland port of this program. It's mostly a piece of kernel code, and so porting the code to a different operating system is not entirely trivial because there are many, many differences between operating systems. So in this talk, we will try to discuss what the issues were in porting the work and what we learned about this work and what we could improve in the architecture of a kernel subsystem to make porting easier. In detail, we start with the motivation and objectives of this work, description of the system being ported, very short one, the strategy that we followed, and then we will discuss all the kernel subsystem involved and how we ported the access to this subsystem from one operating system to another one. So, in brief, the motivation was that we needed to, as part of the European project in which I'm involved, we needed to develop an emulation solution for Planet Lab, which is a distributed testbed for testing network application and distributed application. And there were several options on the plate, including using some of the available Linux packages for emulation, like TC, NetM, NISTnet, NetPath, etc. But none of them was as flexible as Daminet is, apart from the fact that we had already a lot of experience on Daminet. And so even using those native systems would need a significant amount of work. So we decided to go for the port because it also was desirable in itself, not just for the specific application, but because we would have the Daminet system available also on other platforms. And this slide briefly shows how Daminet works. Basically, this is related to Planet Lab, but also applies to FreeBSD. And basically, we have a user space application, which is IPFW, which is the control part, which injects rules into the kernel. And then the kernel processes packets through the protocol stack, passes them to the emulator, and then the packets go back to the protocol stack. In doing this work, we also took a chance to clean up some parts of Daminet or IPFW which were not entirely satisfying or had performance issues. For instance, we had scheduler support to Daminet. In the past, there was only one scheduler available. Now we have a choice of many of them, and then there is a clean API to develop more scheduler modules. We did some work to improve scalability, specifically in the lookup of rules in the firewall. For instance, before this phase had a cost which was linear in the size of a rule set, especially for jump instructions. Now it's logarithmic, and in many cases it's also a constant time because we can put a direct reference to the target of jump. We also provided some tools for user-level testing of part of the system, which was very important because sometimes the algorithms are not entirely trivial, and for instance, schedulers sometimes are not entirely trivial, and testing them within the kernel makes it very hard to reproduce the potential situation where we could have errors. Also, the main goal was to have a Linux version that would work on a specific version of Planet Lab. But it wasn't too hard to extend the work to a generic Linux version and to OpenWRT, which is interesting because it runs on a variety of very, very cheap hardware. And also, we tried to make a port to Windows, which extended the availability of the tool to a much larger user base. Now, so this is basically a description in more detail of the system. We have a user part, which does nothing strange, just communicates with the kernel through a socket with the sectsocopt, and several kernel modules which do the classification, basically the firewall, the emulation, schedulers, etc., and they are attached to pfilter hooks. Since this code was written 15 years ago and without portability in mind, it only uses FreeBSD-specific APIs and subsystems, and so everything is written basically just using what is available on FreeBSD. And so we have several subsystems that might differ from one platform to another. And in detail, we have MBAFs, pfilter hooks, memory allocator locking, timer services, etc. All the things listed here, basically. The approach that we tried to follow was to make as little as possible modification to the original code. Sometimes you, when you port something and you have access to the source code, you try to modify the source code so that it fits all the platform. I tried this in the past with different kernel subsystems, and it was a mistake because when you do that, you need to have an intimate knowledge of the system that you're going to modify because you risk to introduce new bugs. Instead, keeping the original source unmodified, at least you're sure that you're not breaking the original system, and you're only working on the interfaces between the original system and the underlying operating system. And so this makes the porting much faster and less error prone, and also it makes it easier to keep the software up to date because the glue doesn't change even if the dominant of the system that you're porting changes over time. You might have a small performance loss in this process because sometimes adapting the APIs involves some data duplication, data copies, etc. But at least at this stage of the project, it was considered something completely acceptable. So our work plan was to identify differences between platforms, provide a replacement for headers, which are a big part of the porting work, and wrappers for similar function and subsystems across different operating systems. And then whenever it was necessary to have some glue code to map the FreeBSD kernel APIs to other operating system APIs, we had to do that as well. The important thing, at least for our purposes, is that in all the work that we did, there is absolutely no GPL code. The original code is BSD licensed. The glue code is entirely developed from scratch. Any headers and libraries, etc., that we needed and were not present in Windows or Linux are from BSD licensed sources. And the Windows glue is part of the Microsoft driver development kit. So there is no GPL code. Which might be interesting for... Yes?
Was there previously a port done to other BSDs?
No, although OS X uses Dominet and Dragonfly uses Dominet.
And OpenBSD and
NetBSD? I have no idea. No, and I don't think so, but I'm not considering that part because, first of all, they are very, very similar at that stage. And second thing, I mean, I guess any porting that would be trivial if there are people interested in those areas.
Easier than jumping to a completely different library.
So the user space code is almost trivial. The APIs are very standard, especially if you on Windows if you're using Cygwin, which is a Unix-like environment. There are no strange linker tricks or other. Or the things that you need depend a lot on the compiler. The main points where we needed to act were adaptation of the headers because the header trees are different even in user space between operating systems, and this will be discussed next. There are some missing library functions. For instance, one very strange is humanized number, which prints number in a human readable form. So if you have very gigabytes, et cetera, you don't have 10 digits, but you have something more readable. And they're coming from BSD library source code. In Windows, there was a minor difference because the sectsocopt does not exist there. There is an equivalent function which is called device IO control. It uses a device handle instead of a socket, but it's pretty similar to that in principle. And the other thing we needed to emulate was the sysctl interface, which is not available on Linux or Windows. Linux has a slightly a similar thing, which is the proc or sys file system, and we actually mapped the syscontrol to the sys file system on Linux. On Windows, there is no such thing, so we completely emulated that over the socopt or the device IO control. And all the extensions are in just one file, which is 800 lines of code, but it's mostly coming from copies of library functions and syscontrol emulation. I'm mentioning the size of the code through this code to give you the idea of how much work was involved in this port. User space on Windows with Windows tools is slightly more difficult because they have their own idea of standards, and especially I think they are very concerned about backward compatibility. So if you take the Microsoft compiler and others, they are full of this definition of Word, the Word file, which date back for 30 years perhaps to the old 8086 CPU. And many programs still use those definitions, and so we have to do a slightly bigger remapping of headers and APIs. There are some things that are missing on native Windows compilers. For instance, we don't have fork process control. Printer formats are different. C99 initializer not supported, etc. And so for some things, we needed to put more header tricks and defines to disable or remap to nothing the missing function. But overall, the work was pretty easy. Again, we have only two small if-def sections, which are conditional on TCC. TCC is one tiny C compiler by Fabrice Bellard. It's a very nice and small compiler and very fast, which can produce Windows binaries. And I like it a lot because I can produce Windows binaries cross-compiling on FreeBSD, which is very convenient for me. So we only have two small sections of this code in over 7,000 lines of the IPFW user space code. The kernel side is much more interesting because the APIs are completely non-standards across operating systems, so each system implements its own, even if they are, we found out that mostly equivalent across systems, but just the interfaces are different. Headers are completely different. Things are in one place on a system, in another place on another system. And also, we have many more subsystems involved. In the user space, part, we only have the setsocopt interface. In the kernel, we have a variety of subsystems that we use. The main tool to reduce differences and improve portability was based on header remapping and a larger use of macros to remap functions and reduce the difference from a system to another one. So the first step that we follow in the port was to try and build the kernel code in a user space. So make a user space version of the kernel module. And this was done to quickly find out which were the header dependencies, which were the missing library function, etc. And also we could try a few approaches to, for instance, replace the missing header with others or figure out what was the most convenient way to wrap missing function into macros or other subsystem. In a sense, it was not a wasted effort because eventually we came up with a daemon which could be run in user space and could talk to the SB and IPFW to an emulated socopt interface, which makes it very convenient to test, for instance, large rule sets, injection, printing, and so on. Also, it was useful because as part of this work, we also wrote some code that allows testing schedulers in user space. This was something I presented yesterday. And also, the plan now is to add some code to handle packets, for instance, coming from a pickup file or some other stream. And so that would allow us also to test the packet matching functionality and performance directly in user space, which is also something that we really need to do to figure out whether our code is, first of all, correct, and second of all, if there are any optimization that could be done. Now, after finding out which were the problematic place of the code, we started doing the header remapping. So FreeBSD doesn't, as a strategy, doesn't use nested headers. So basically, every source file starts with a large number of includes of various system headers. And Certainly, we didn't want to touch all these source files and modify the list of headers. So we had to provide replacement for all these systems. And the replacement was done taking care of these criteria and constraints. So first of all, some BSD headers are missing on other platforms. Some have the same name but a different content. Some have a different name for more or less the same type of content. And also, from many, many headers, we just include a handful of lines, just probably because of historical reasons. So our approach was the following. First of all, we disabled the standard includes from the compiler, and then forced the inclusion on every source files of a couple of headers containing common definition and other headers that are needed, like types, .h, and so on. And these common definitions are about 1,000 lines. Then we have a subtree, which is include, which contains about 30 headers, which are copied almost verbatim from FreeBSD. And so that makes a build environment which is very similar to the one that you will find in FreeBSD. And then there is a large number of remaining headers, about 50, which have no interesting content. They had only a few lines in the original code, but those few lines are either covered by the forced includes or by these other subtrees now. And so basically these remaining headers have no interesting content. So in the make file, there is an entry that produces a subtree with the files that we need because the source expects them, but they are completely empty. So they don't pollute the repository. They are built on the fly during the compilation. And so this is what this is the set of flags that are passed to the compiler for each kernel file. Just related to the header remapping. And a similar strategy was used also to build a user space version, except that the set of files involved is much smaller than that. What is in the headers that we include? Well, mostly stuff that remaps names from FreeBSD to names and function and subsystem available on the other operating system. And there is a variety of things from simply renaming fields or structures to renaming function to mapping function to other function, possibly swapping arguments and so on. And for instance, the last one is the way we use on Linux to remap syscontrol declaration to calls to generate entries for the sys file system on Linux. And most of these macros are coming from a comparison of what is available on one system and on the other, and then figuring out what is the best way to replace something. Then after that, we are left with a few things that need to be dealt explicitly by writing function or figuring out what's the most appropriate way to map things. And so in the next slides, we will cover all of these items. First of all, packet representation on the different systems, memory allocation, locking timers, module support, user line kernel communication is already done, and this part is basically a list of things that are available or not available in the various versions of IPFW and Dominet. So packet representation is the first thing that we looked at. Basically, in all operating systems, the packets are represented by a descriptor, which contains metadata, and then a linked list of buffers. On FreeBSD, the format clearly is different on different operating systems, but the idea is the same. So on FreeBSD, we have mbuffs, and all of our code uses mbuffs. On Linux, there are skbuffs, which are mostly the same thing with a different layout. And on Windows, the structure is called ndispacket. So the strategy that we follow is, given that our code is already written to use mbuff, whenever we get a packet to be processed, be it an skbuff or an ndispacket, we try to build something that looks like an mbuff and contains metadata from the original representation and has either a link to the original data or a copy of the data, depending on how the packets are handled by the various operating systems. So basically, we allocate this block. This picture represents the work that we do. We allocate this fake mbuff. When we get a packet, we fill it with the copies of the metadata from the original data from the original representation, and we try to also put a reference to the payload of the packet unless we are forced to make an explicit copy. And then the code only processes this mbuff. Whenever the processing is complete and the packet is returned to the original operating system, we just destroy this thing, and the original packet is there. The details on what we need to copy and what we can reference depend on how the packet filtering hooks work in the operating system. In FreeBSD, we have pfil hooks, and basically a hook function receives an mbuff pointer, but it is allowed to free the packet or can keep it for itself and return it at a later time. And this is actually a slight problem because other systems don't have a similar thing. And we needed to emulate the behavior of pfil hooks, so that's why this is a problem. In Linux, we have netfilter hooks. The idea is that you get a packet, you have to return immediately the packet with a marker that says what to do with the packet, which could be keep it or drop it, or send it to another subsystem which is, allows you to do delayed processing of the packet. And this delayed processing is called Q. When you return a packet to Linux marked as Q, then you will get another callback with a copy of the packet, and then you can do whatever you like with the packet, including return it after some time, or mark it eventually as a packet to be dropped. In Windows, we have a different API, which is called ndisminiport. And basically, packets are passed up and down. There are various ways to pass packets up and down. The one we use does not allow modification to the packet itself. So basically, you get a packet, you can look at it, but you have more or less to immediately return a response saying what you want to do with the packet. And this forces us to completely replicate the packet if we want to delay transmission as Dumbnet does. There are in this process, so in this adaptation, there are some necessary data copies that we could spare. For instance, if we in the pfilter hooks we had a more clear separation between the classification part and the actual action part, whether we need to drop a packet, pass it to a NAT module, delay it to Dumbnet, etc. If we had a more clear separation, we could save some copies. Right now, we need to make a complete copy of the packet in Windows, and we also need to allocate a descriptor in Linux, even if these packets are marked by the firewall as accept or not subject to emulation. This is something that I will probably try to fix in the future, also on FreeBSD. Memory allocation. So the basic memory allocator uses malloc on FreeBSD, and this is easily mapped to kmalloc on Linux and xallocate pool with tag on Windows. We have optimized allocator for objects with fixed size. They are called UMA zone allocators. And the interface of this allocator is this one, zcreate, zalloc, zfree, zdestroy, to create a region for this fixed size object. This one is to allocate one entry from this region, free, destroy the zone, etc. So I tried different things, including replicating the UMA allocator from FreeBSD, but eventually I figured out that this is something that performance doesn't bother me too much at the moment. So the only useful information that we have from a zone is the size of the blocks that you are going to allocate. So basically, the replacement of the UMA allocator is just the one that you see on the right. When we create a zone, we return just the length as an identifier of the zone. And then when we do an allocation from a zone, we take the identifier of the zone, which is just the length, and we pass it directly to malloc. So that's an easy trick that allows us to completely replace the subsystem with the malloc-based one. Locking. So fortunately, we have a very simple locking mechanism in IPFW and Dumbnet. We either use read-write locks or read-mostly locks and mutexes. And so the access is only through shared or exclusive locks and mutexes. If we had something more complex like RCU on Linux, it would have been a lot more difficult to port it. So basically, what we do is, given that locks are defined in different ways in a different operating system, we wrap the calls to the locks in macros, unless they are already, some of our call to locks are already mapped to wrapped in macros, and then we define the macros appropriately on each operating system. So on Linux, we map the locks on spin locks, and on Windows on fast mutexes. So that's relatively easy to do. Timers and callouts. We use timers for two purposes. One is to return the time of day with a sufficient resolution, and the other one is to invoke a callback after some time, or wake up a thread after some time. For the first part, in FreeBSD, we use get micro uptime or micro uptime, and there is something equivalent on Linux, which is do get time of day. On Windows, we needed to build a custom replacement because we couldn't find any standard function that had a resolution than less than 10 milliseconds. So we use something which is based on the TSC. And fortunately, the thread that calls the timers is forced to use is locked on a single CPU. So we don't have too much trouble with CPUs with different TSC values. Rather than the TSC, we are probably going to use something that doesn't change its rate with power down, with power management in the future. The other part, which is the part that wakes up a callback after or a thread after some time, the interface on FreeBSD is based on callout init and callout reset, and there is almost a one-to-one mapping to the timer function on Windows, on Linux. On Windows, we use this mechanism, which is called deferred procedure calls, which again is similar to the callout mechanism on FreeBSD. The hardest part was that this deferred procedure call, in here as an argument, we can specify when we want to be called. But again, the resolution was around 10 milliseconds. And it was really hard to find this particular function with which we could put down the resolution to 1 millisecond. It was not documented on the standard Windows documentation. Even asking to our colleagues at Microsoft and kernel developers and Microsoft, we couldn't get a pointer to this function, which is really strange because I think many multimedia things really need a higher resolution than the 10 milliseconds that is default on Windows. Module support is what lets the kernel dynamically load modules at runtime. And in FreeBSD, there are a few macros that declare a module and point to a descriptor which contains initializer, construction, and the structure for the module, and also defines the dependency of the module. This is heavily based on linker sets. So those are compiler features that might not be available on different tool chains, for instance, Microsoft Visual C or TCC. The workaround that we used was to redefine those macros so that those scripts were made globally visible. And then we have a list of module descriptor which is built either manually or in the future we can try to automate that. And when the module starts, we call the constructor of each entry on this list. And the same when the module is released and unloaded. Communication from kernel to user and vice versa. As I said already, there is a get socopt and set socopt on a raw socket, and Linux has a similar thing, just the API and the structure that is passed up and down is different, but that's no big deal. The adaptation does not involve any data copy. And the same on Windows, except that the name of the function is different and the mechanism is slightly different. The messages that go up and down in the original version were only related to injecting rules or listing firewall rules or injecting configuration for dummy net entities. And now we extended it to also emulate sysctl. So basically, whatever you can do with the sysctl command in those platforms, you do with the IPFW sysctl and then all the rest. Other specific issues, so there are not many things to mention, except that, of course, some features are not available on different platforms just because they are not natively available or because we were lazy and didn't bother about porting them. But anyways, sysctl are mapped to sysmodule on Linux 2.6 something, and on 2.4 something they are implemented via SOCOPT. The jail ID, which is something which is present in FreeBSD, is replaced by the vServer ID. vServer is a mechanism for virtualization that is present in Linux and was something that actually is used on Planet Lab to make different virtual machine available to each user of the platform. And at the moment, IPv6 and the internal NAT are not available on the Linux version, just because we were lazy. It shouldn't be too hard to add support for IPv6. The major difficulty we had in this porting work was that Linux are very unstable kernel APIs. Basically, for every change in the X here, you have changes in some of the API that are involved. So the porting code has many, many conditional sections that do something specific on 2.6.22, 23, 25, 27, and so on and so on. In this respect, Windows and FreeBSD are a lot more stable and easier to work with. I don't have any plans to integrate this stuff in the Linux source tree. I'm maintaining the code as an external module. Windows-specific issues. Sysctl, again, is implemented with SetSocopt or equivalent. There is no jail or user ID or group ID matching, just because I'm not aware of a way to get this information on Windows. There is no matching on interface names. Interface names on Windows are strings that are 50 characters long and unpronounceable. You have human readable forms of the interface name, which is still very long and it's not and can be ambiguous because the same it represents the interface type, but not the specific instance on the system. Again, IPv6 and internal NAT are not implemented. One difficulty on Windows is that loopback traffic doesn't go through the NDIS interface. So there is no way to intercept loopback traffic, either directed to 127.0.0.1 or directed to the IP address of the machine. This is really annoying because a very useful feature of dummy net is that you could test application on just one machine without being connected to a network. And here in Windows, you cannot do that. There are probably tricks which involve writing some NAT module that intercepts traffic directed to a foreign address and bounces it back to the machine. The glue that makes the NDIS module talk to dummy net comes mostly from the miniport driver, which is part of the Windows driver development kit. We had a small set of changes to this miniport driver, which are perhaps 100 lines or so. And of course, when developing the Windows version, we also had to care about installer files so that the typical user can be presented with the usual interface, next, 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 done. And we also provide signed kernel modules we know how to provide signed kernel modules because Windows on 64-bit systems requires signed kernel modules to allow them to be loaded in the operating systems. The porting effort overall, we have a few files that are involved, which are listed here, and the size of these files is also listed on this column. Basically, overall, it's about 4,000 lines of code. The division is uh, the glue.h and TCC glue.h is stuff that allows compiling the code with foreign compilers. Glue.c is what implements the syscontrol and missing libraries. Missing.h is stuff that contains missing header definitions for the kernel. BSD compat is BSD APIs. IPFW2mod.c is the glue that allows you to build a Linux module, so calling all the interfaces that are needed on Linux to build and load a module. MDWin, machine-dependent function that are only needed on Windows, and winmissing.h are header changes that are needed for Windows. What we learned? Well, there are a few things that could be done better on the FreeBSD code, and we plan to work on them in the future. First of all, as I said, we need to have a better split between the classification part, which is done by IPFW and decides what to do on the packet, and the actual emulation part or action on the packet. If we could split this behavior, we would not need to make a copy of a packet up front, in all cases, but we could just do the copy on those packets that are subject to emulation. So we could improve performance a lot. The original FreeBSD code has some confusion because of the endianness of certain fields for historical reasons. IPLAN, IP offset, and other fields change from host to network representation in different points on the stack. And this makes the code obfuscated and also requires that you have write access to this mbuff or these clusters. And this is really annoying. If we could get rid of that, the code would be a lot simpler and probably more efficient because we wouldn't need to do a pull-up to bring stuff into the writable portion of the mbuff. The use of nested includes in the kernel would have made the porting a lot simpler. And in fact, in general, I would think it would make the code a lot smaller. For instance, in the work that we did to build a pluggable scheduler for Daminet, all the scheduler modules starts with the 10-15 headers that are included, and that's completely pointless. I mean, all the schedulers need the same set of headers. It would have been much simpler to have just one header that includes everything which is required. And the other thing, when you have a subsystem which can be implemented differently in different operating system, or for which the actual implementation might change because, for instance, you switch from a mutex to a read-write locks to a read-multi lock, etc., it would be very useful to wrap these calls into macros, and so just replace the macro definition to either to use a different subsystem or to port the code to a different operating system. Availability and credits. So the code is available on my Daminet page above, and it's already into FreeBSD head and stable 8. On my page, you find sources and pre-built binary modules for Linux, OpenWRT, Windows XP, Windows 7, both 32 and 64-bit. OS X currently has an older version of IPFW and Daminet. I was hoping that Jordan would be in the room and ask and answer whether he's interested in porting it to importing the new version to OS X. Last, I want to thank my students who worked with me on the project, Marta Carbone, who did a lot of work on the Linux port, Fabio Cecconi, who worked on the schedulers, Riccardo Panicucci, worked on the scheduler API, and Francesco Magno, who did the Windows port. And that's all. Questions are welcome. Yes?
So I remember a few years back, I think that what would be involved in porting Daminet at that point in time to NetBSD. And what seemed like was going to be the biggest challenge was the fact that Daminet was very much tied to NetGraph at that point.
It is not at all.
No. Okay. Someone gave me that explanation at the time.
I don't expect a lot of problems, except perhaps the way packet filter hooks work. And as I said,
ether hooks are the same between NetBSD and NetGraph.
Could be.
MBUFs differ slightly. So it might.
So one thing that Aminet uses is that packets that are going to Aminet are tagged with mTags, but mTags are mostly the same across systems. So I really don't expect any problem. I don't like very much the way DSP filter hooks work. And this is part of my fault, because when I designed the original Aminet, there wasn't a hook. So I wrote custom code to hook the packet into IP output and IP input. And didn't think that classification and emulation were two different things. So if I did it again, I would split it. I would put two separate calls. But again, porting to NetBSD, I mean, I wouldn't expect any major problem in porting to NetBSD or OpenBSD.
And would you think at this point in time that Dummy.net would serve as a complete replacement for all the functionality that was in AltView?
So the set of schedulers that are implemented are different, and the layer at which it works is slightly different. AltView hooks directly into the output queue of the device driver. Which is probably not a good idea for one reason, especially with high-speed cards. You really need to the queue to have a number of entries so it can be processed in batches for efficiency. On the other hand, it would be good to have the output interface tell you when the transmit queue is empty, so it can act as a clock for the output queue. For the scheduler, basically. Actually, this is a functionality that Aminet already supported 10 years ago. There is a specific option in the command line to specify that the bandwidth is clocked by an interface instead of set explicitly by the user. There was only one driver at the time which supported this functionality, which was the AD driver. So in a sense, yes, I think it could become a replacement for AltView, as long as you don't want exactly that particular scheduling algorithm that is implemented on AltView.
Well, I think AltView has never seen wide usage. I think because there are some exponential handling cases in AltViews.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have to say that some of the scheduling algorithm in AltView, in principle, would be interesting, like the hierarchical arrangement of schedulers. But this is something that I plan to port to Aminet as well. Yes?
I'm actually interested in porting AltView to these architectures. Do you think one could use some of the similar techniques that you used to do this?
I have no idea, because the problem I see with AltView is that it hooks directly into the device driver, which is... Yes. Besides, there are probably not so clear APIs at the device driver level. I mean, here, we are lucky that there is a clear API for intercepting packets. At device driver level, probably this is not true. Okay. I think I'm not. Thanks. Thank you.